Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Well, live from the Toby Family Auditorium at the Commonwealth Club, it's Week to Week, the political roundtable for Monday, December 11th, 2017. Welcome, everybody. Before the evening gets too late, let me just say happy holidays to everybody.
Happy holidays. Here, here.
Now, last week, the International Olympic Committee banned Russia from competing in the Winter Olympics in retaliation for Russia's widespread athlete doping program. White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders briefly floated the idea that the United States would boycott the Olympics, but that was squashed. But it led one online WEG to declare, "Since Russia will not be allowed to compete in the 2018 Winter Olympics, President Trump has invited them to take part in the 2018 midterm elections." I'm John Zipper, your host for Week to Week and the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial. On tonight's program, we're going to discuss the Congressional Tax Bill, Al Franken, Jerusalem, the LA wildfires, and our year-end roundup of the best and worst political news. Well, of course, end the evening with our live news quiz, which results in chocolate prizes. I always like to note that the Commonwealth Club is a place for people with a wide range of views, so any opinions that are expressed up here tonight are those solely of the speakers and not of the Commonwealth Club. So let's meet our panelists for tonight. I'm going to start on the far end of the stage with Carson Bruno. He's the Assistant Dean for Admission and Program Relations for Pepperdine University's School of Public Policy. He's on Twitter at CarsonJFBruno. Welcome, Carson. Thank you. Next to him is Barbara Marshman. She's the editorial pages editor for the Mercury News, and she's on Twitter at bmarshman.
Barb Marshman.
And next to me is Chuck Nevius, C.W. Nevius, he's a columnist for the Santa Rosa Press Democrat, longtime columnist for the San Francisco Chronicle, and he's on Twitter at C.W. Nevius. I got at least part of that correct. There are question cards spread throughout the room. I think you all know how we do it. Write down some questions. People will collect them and deliver them to me, and I will try to ask as many as possible during this hour. So on to our roundtable. We're going to talk about the single most exciting, sexy topic ever. It's tax reform. Now, there are different tax bills that were passed by the U.S. House of Representatives and the U.S. Senate just in recent weeks. And currently, Senate and House Republicans have been trying to stitch together a compromise bill that they can get to be onto the president's desk within the next 2 or 3 weeks. Carson, these bills were both pulled together pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. That's been criticized by some. Does that matter? Because really what we're talking about is ideas that have been pushed and written about and urged by conservatives and Republicans for decades.
I think the key here is that they were both really written rather quickly because they were meant to be vehicles, really to get a tax bill passed in both House so that then the two houses can come together and really kind of then flesh out the true details. And so it's really hard right now to really determine what ultimately will end up being the tax reform. What will it look like? What will it do? And so it's a little bit jarring to kind of see all these analyses and, you know, Larry Summers coming out and saying 10,000 people are going to die every year because of the tax bill. like, whoa. That's pretty draconian, dude. But because we don't really know ultimately what will come out of the Senate and the House and what will end up being passed and sent to President Trump and signed. Now, I think two things most definitely will be incorporated into the tax bill. A lot of things will be, but I think two things in particular that will really affect Californians, but also could affect Californian policy going forward. And that's the SALT as well as the mortgage interest deductions, the SALT being the state and local tax deduction. Both of those will definitely be incorporated somehow into the final package, reducing kind of those deductions in some capacity, whether it's, you know, eliminating the mortgage interest deduction on like everything, you know, below $1 million or $500,000 on home values, or when it comes to the SALT, whether it's property taxes or income taxes or sales taxes, what kind of combination of the state and local taxes it is, remains to be seen. But this will have huge ramifications for California, A, being a very unaffordable location to buy homes, particularly new homes, as well as being a very high tax state when it comes to realistically property taxes, sales taxes, and income taxes. And so this is going to really affect Californians themselves. So on the short term, you'll probably see a lot of actually short-term kind of pain when it comes to what this tax bill means for Californians, particularly coastal Californians. But in the long term, if it actually means that it's going to force Sacramento to really start to really take into consideration these policies that they've been essentially being subsidized for by the federal government for quite some time, that means we could actually might see some kind of action taken on reducing this boom and bust roller coaster ride that we have when it comes to our personal income tax system, or actually taking some sort of actual action on making housing affordable, particularly in coastal California. And so ultimately, I think it could end up being a net positive for California, depending on kind of what happens with these items.
You're such an optimist, Carson.
I hope so. I'm young, so I need to be an optimist at times.
Good for you.
Barbara, what are you watching most in this?
Well, trying to watch all of that and take some of it personally. But the thing we really watch as a paper is we're in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. And the plan to bring the offshore money back at a lower tax rate has been very disappointing because it does nothing to channel that tax money into a particular useful cause. There will be no benefit to the community. It's not going to create jobs. Didn't last time. No reason you would create more jobs than you need now. Can't really grow much faster than we are now. But industry had put forward a plan that negotiate a rate, get the rate down a little bit, but, you know, we'll pay a substantial rate, but use that money to build infrastructure, to fix the roads, to fix the bridges, to shore up the dams, to do all these things, because industry needs that too, and we all do, and in fact, President Trump campaigned on trying to do something about it. But it is not in the plan. There's just a cut rate to bring the money back, and it will go to shareholders and executive bonuses, and that's fine, but it won't have any broader benefit. Actually, the Silicon Valley Leadership Group has already written a pretty clear letter to our congressional delegation and other folks talking about this, wanting to get it done, and I believe there is another fairly major group kind of like them who might be joining with them sometime later this week to do a joint Bay Area presentation. I didn't mean that as a hint. to get, you know, the whole industry together on this. It's an odd thing for industry to be saying, look, we want to bring this money back, but we don't want to give it to we don't want to just give it to our shareholders. We want something good to come out of it. And I don't know that we're hopeful, but we haven't given up.
Chuck, does it matter what we do with taxes? Isn't legalized pot going to solve everything?
It is going to solve everything. First of all, I'm leaving my money offshore. So let's just... it's staying offshore. Angus King, who is the senator from Maine, an independent, said that there were going to be three results from this bill. And the first one was that he said that Republicans will put on their very serious face and say, this deficit is a very serious issue and we're going to have to address it. And the shadow concern with that is that they will address it by saying we need to cut back on entitlement programs like health care. And that's obviously been a Republican idea for a long time. In fact, Paul Ryan just said that again, that medical costs are a big part of this. So the concern is this is step one of now we're headed to cutting entitlement costs. The second thing he said is we're going to find some really stinky things in this bill. And it was done so fast, mm-hmm. as Carson says. There's a provision in there for a tax credit for maintenance of your private plane. So at least all of us get an opportunity to
thank God that
my private plane is not going to be a problem. And the third thing he said was, which I really liked, was any good thing that happens from now on, including, as he said, good weather at the Super Bowl, will be attributed to this bill. You know, I think it's just, no one knows what's in it. No one knows what's happened. Again, Angus King called it the most important vote in 30 years, and we're kind of doing it on the fly because we need to have a win for the party in power.
One of the things that Carson had already brought up that we know is in sort of each of the House and the Senate versions of the bill, if you will, does address this issue of, in different ways, goes at the issue of mortgage interest deduction. And as he indicated, you know, it's currently capped at $1 million. The House version, but not the Senate version, would bring that down to $500,000. And just a second here. According to Business Insider, the share of recent purchase loans from $500,000 to $1 million, so between $500,000 and $1 million, is as high as 48% in San Francisco, 38% in Los Angeles, 22% in Washington, D.C. At the same time, putting on my Republican hat, it's not that people would not be receiving any tax relief. I mean, they would still receive it on, if it, say it was lowered to $500,000, they'd still receive it on the first $500,000 worth of the mortgage interest, or the mortgage debt, excuse me. Is it really going to have much of an impact? I mean, the realtors are being very critical of this, and they're saying, oh, it's really going to hurt. Well, what can be bad for the seller can be very good for the buyer. And as we know, it's very bad for the buyer right now in California. So I want to start with you, Carson, because I know housing is one of your areas of expertise.
What it's not so much, it may not impact the first time buyer as much, because in likelihood, the first time buyer isn't really the demographic that's going to be itemizing their taxes in the first place. They'll largely be taking the standard deduction. And so all of these deductions really don't really play into their taxes. it's really those people who are currently in their homes that may be looking to either move into another home or kind of move into a downsizing their home, where then they're going to be really hit hard because they've already gotten the full mortgage interest deduction, but then aren't going to be getting that kind of the full benefit in the next home that they purchase, which will still be an expensive home if they plan to stay in California. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to game out, but I think ultimately what it will do is it will force local politicians particularly to start to pay attention to the housing affordability crisis, because all of a sudden you will have now lots of people who are not being able to be subsidized into purchasing these unaffordable homes. And they will be now clamoring to their local politicians to actually do something about the unaffordability crisis within their localities and their communities. Which then could work its way up to the state. And the state's already, I mean, many state senators, particularly Scott Wiener here in San Francisco, has already really taken this on as a major campaign issue and a major political issue for himself. But there are still many in Sacramento who are hesitant to really either think of this as a state problem, but also more particularly as a problem in general. You have politicians from Marin County who don't really see this as an issue at all, and are actually trying to stop any sort of efforts from the state. So it's kind of this mixed bag where it needs to happen at the local level, and this may be kind of the impetus that actually forces individuals at the local level to really start to kind of create that rally cry to cause some action on the issue.
Barbara?
I heard a ripple in the audience when you said that first-time home buyers don't. And I'm probably like most of you, I think we're of an age mostly, 40 years ago when I bought my first house, I immediately went to deductions. And I actually caught this in a column that my colleague Dan Borenstein from the East Bay Times wrote about this and said first-time home buyers. And I said, whoa, that's not true. But apparently, studying now what the situation is, Carson is right, Dan was right, I was wrong. It is the case now that, and I think particularly with the tax reform bill that's out there, there will be more people doing the standard deduction. So, yeah. So that is something. I think it is. It makes no sense in the long term for us to be subsidizing people to buy these, you know, crazy houses or just little cottages worth $2 million. But I think it should be eased in a little more. The way it's out there now, it's just going to happen next year. And I think that would be crazy and unfair to people who bought and sold things in good faith, and everything, if you do it all at once, everything changing at once, never a good idea.
I'd say, you know, affordable housing is the economic issue of California, especially on the West Coast. Mm-hmm. I'll be here all night. Thank you very much. One of the studies that I saw, though, when George Bush was president and cut taxes, one of the things that happened is they went back and talked to those people who had their taxes cut. And 50% of them saw no difference. They didn't, and 24% thought their taxes went up. You know, the question is this something that's going to make a difference in affordable housing in San Francisco and California along the West Coast? And there are so many factors that, I mean, I would raise the issue of Prop 13. You know, the Howard Jarvis hold the line on tech. I'm delighted to hear that. This was applause. I was afraid there'd be boos and hisses. But I mean, that is a. It's one of those ideas that sounds great in theory, and in practice, it has really hamstrung the affordable housing and the housing market in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. It can be done. It's not a tremendous hardship. You understand the deal is that the idea is to keep housing taxes low as long as you stay in your house. It doesn't go up as the value of your home goes up. And there's even a way to do it without impacting homeowners. You could do it with corporate or business taxes, and that would also provide a tax base. But that's the kind of thing that it's painful. People don't want to do it. And yet, once it happened, I think people would be in favor of it. We know it has to be easier to get into housing. It has to be. Mm-hmm. And once that happens, people will move up. There'll be openings created. It's math. It's simple. It just isn't happening. And maybe something like this will make a difference. Maybe that's what pushes us over the top. But that issue, affordable housing, is huge.
The House bill, but not the Senate bill, also has something that would eliminate the mortgage interest deduction for second homes. And that had been floated by a California, I think, a Democratic state lawmaker a while ago. And isn't that certainly something worth, you know, I mean, that second home is, one assumes, either a luxury or a business investment, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. business meaning for a family, even so, it's still an investment. Yeah. Would that be kind of, it's not that that would bring in huge amounts of money, but isn't that kind of a no-brainer if you're going to be cutting back somewhere?
I mean, it would bring in quite a bit of money. I mean, particularly in a state like California, where places, particularly coastal California, but then also in the Sierra Mountains, I mean, many of those homes are second homes,
right.
Either for Californians or for out-of-staters. And you're right. This was floated and proposed, and it was killed in committee in Sacramento by the Democrat. It was proposed by a Democrat, and it was killed by the Democratic leadership because there just wasn't the stomach for it amongst the Democratic rank and file within Sacramento, because it was kind of hitting at the donors in a way. And no one likes to be – the donors don't like being attacked. And whether you're in democratically controlled Sacramento or Republican-controlled D.C., the donors continue to have a lot of say in what makes it out of committee and what doesn't.
I think we've found in talking to San Francisco politicians that have moved up to the state legislature, what you find is that it's very definite there are two parts to California. This is not a surprise, the Valley and the coast. And, you know, I don't want to mention names, but Scott Wiener and David Chu. But, you know, they're proposing affordable housing ideas, and people in the Valley are saying, what are you talking about? What's the problem? We're not having any problems with that. So you've really got to craft something that has both urban and also maybe a rural component to it. And I think that's the difficult part of it. And getting to the point where you realize that this actually is an important problem, which I'm not sure we've reached that point.
Well, someone actually, right along with what you were talking about earlier in the audience, says, how, if at all, what impacts, if any, would tax reform have on Prop 13? I pay more taxes on my less than $1 million condo than owners of $20 million homes who can take their low tax payments with them. Don't we need a better way of distributing the pain?
Yes. Yes, we do. We do.
Yeah. I think there is movement against Prop 13 for the first time since Prop 13 was really put on the ballot and passed. You're starting to see a lot of particularly statewide elected officials who are willing to go on the record saying that they are not fans of Prop 13, Antonio Villagrosa just being the most recent one, basically suggesting that he would be open to some sort of amending of Prop 13. Now, the big question is, I think when you look at polling that there is actually some stomach for amending Prop 13, but then it becomes the devil in the details. What does that actually mean? What will it actually do? And that's when you start to get into the sticking point of actually how do you amend Prop 13? Yeah, you can do the split role and kind of change the situation for businesses and commercial property. But at the end of the day, that's not going to solve anything when it comes or help anything when it comes to the affordability crisis, because that's all about homes, not business property. So you're going to have to start tinkering with home value or at the how the home value portion of it is on individuals. And will voters really go along with kind of changing how their own property taxes are assessed? I don't really think so, because it has to go to the voters. The state can only do so much because it was passed by the voters. It has to be amended by the voters. And so when push comes to shove, I don't really think the voters will really truly do what needs to be done to really try to fix Prop 13 from the housing affordability perspective.
Just wait till recreational cannabis is passed. It'll change everything.
I said it would solve all problems. Yeah. So, yeah, you're going to keep paying more for your condo than the 20. Question for Barbara. We were talking about this in the back before the program. Susan Collins and some, you know, what her positions on the tax reform. A couple different questions kind of getting at the same thing. Any hope that Susan Collins will vote no? What about, you know, those Republican senators, the Flakes, the McCains, the Collins, who have gone against the grain in the past? Any tea leaf readings on how those might go?
I think there is a real consensus that they need to pass something. And in the end, I think everybody's going to get in line. Now, what someone like Susan Collins can get built in as a trade-off, I don't know. Various people got some trade-offs in the House and the Senate to get bills through. Susan Collins has talked about health care, Medicare in particular, which is something that Republicans are pretty much saying are going to have to go after costs of Medicare, which is old people or older people, since 65 really isn't that old anymore. And that's hard for me to understand, Republicans going for that demographic, because it is a largely Republican, I think, nationwide Republican demographic. But, you know, she may win something along those lines, and then later, you know, who knows what happens. There are no guarantees.
Kind of connected to this, or at least in my mind, is another big vote that Congress took recently, which was a two-week funding bill for the federal government. So, you know, there's all this talk about, you know, government shutdown and which senators were going to do a throwdown to get whatever they wanted to prevent that. They voted for a two-week extension, which puts it on December 22nd, I believe, when they will have to vote again or face a government shutdown. So, you know, Merry Christmas. do you think you might see some kind of cross, you know, I may not get what I want on this bill, I mean, give me what I want on the tax bill, or I'm going to be voting against the government funding. Do you think they might do some of that, the Collinses or the Flakes or others?
But I think we've seen this movie, haven't we? They've done this before. It's a chicken. It's a game of chicken. We go down to the end, and everybody gets what they can. Make the best possible deal out of what they've got available. And then, you know, we've definitively proved that shutting down the government is not a winning strategy, right? We've done that. Yeah. And that didn't work. And so I think they have to do something. It's a matter of how much horse trading they can do. And maybe it's a way to force the two parties to actually, crazy idea, but get together and come up with a compromise.
It's possible, but conservatives, I went to a gathering of the Conservative Forum Silicon Valley a few years back, the spring after the government shutdown, and they were all very, and this is a room, thousands of people, believe it or not, Conservative Forum, Silicon Valley, they were thrilled.
They weren't all reporters.
They were not reporters. Oh, okay. No, they were not. They were all really, speaker after speaker talked about how great it was that they had shut down the government. I don't think it was a political winner, but I suspect there are some people in Congress who would like to see it happen just because they want to starve the beast.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our next topic, and it's one we've visited before on this program, certainly all over the news. Office holders from both parties have started to lose jobs in recent days as a result of accusations of sexual misconduct. The highest profile scalp so far was Democratic Senator Al Franken, who resigned after more than half of his party colleagues in the Senate called for him to leave. Republican Representative Trent Frank also resigned, as have a number of elected officials in state governments across the country. So let's talk about, if we've kind of moved on to another stage, if you will, of this sexual harassment thing. So start with you, Barbara. I mean, not to start with a woman, but...
Yeah. But to start with a woman.
She was looking at me, so I threw it to her.
Well, I'd like to think this is part of a real culture change. I'm actually just trying to write about this later in the week when we see what happens with Roy Moore tomorrow. I am not sure it is as much as we think it is. I'm heartened by it. It's getting to the point now, it's a drumbeat that is getting harder to follow because it keeps going, and people are starting to say, well, wait, this isn't quite right. I know Al Franken has a lot of defenders. I heard a few out here. And what he is accused of doing is really not as bad as what President Trump said he did in the Access Hollywood tape. So I'm not sure how much of a trend it is. I'm not sure that it goes down, that goes out of entertainment and out of politics and down into the general workplace and changes anything. I hope it does, but we're not going to know that as easily. And women who are afraid, who are intimidated in the workplace, I don't think they're probably feeling much better about it now than they did before. It's different if your harasser is an elected official and you can say, this happened to me, and there's a news story. But if it's a if it's John at the Commonwealth Club, who...
Uh-oh.
I'm leaving to spend more time with my family.
Yeah.
Up until now, John, I've defended you, but I have to say...
The calls for me to resign will suddenly start coming from every quarter.
Well, I think it has changed. I think that one of the things that, I mean, today's news out of the White House was that the accusers of President Trump had once again stated their cases. And the White House said, look, this was litigated in the election. We had an election. They knew it. They knew that this was all there. It's already been done. But the difference is those allegations didn't get traction then. And now they are getting traction. And Kellyanne Conway from the White House said, you know what? I said this in 2010 and nobody listened to me. Well, people are listening now.
Yeah.
And people are losing their jobs. And the only disturbing part, I think, is that the people like Al Franken who say, okay, I probably did some things. And that was 8 women, okay? Mm-hmm. It wasn't one person with a grudge. He said, okay, maybe I have. And there was a call for him to resign, and he did. But Roy Moore and President Trump have just adamantly denied the charges, and they still have their jobs. And I think that's the issue we have to settle is, what is proof? What is deniability? What is culpability? And I'm not seeing it yet, but I think we're a lot closer than we were 9 months ago.
Oh, yes.
A year ago.
I just wonder how long it will take for it to...
I'm concerned about how, bringing it into now California, and particularly what we're seeing in Sacramento, how kind of unapologetic everyone really seems to be in Sacramento. The special committee that did their hearing a few weeks ago in the assembly, all of their members were right on points, their questions were very intense to the panelists. But Kevin Mullen, who is the chair of the ethics committee, seemed very unapologetic about the process, essentially claiming, well, it's working. Don't worry, it's working. But he couldn't really explain how it was working or actually what was actually happening to these investigations or these accusations. The assembly HR director couldn't really even tell you what was actually had been claimed or accused and had no statistics and kept on saying, well, we just don't keep that information. We don't keep that data. And so they were kind of all shrugging their shoulders like, well, we're doing what we're supposed to be doing. What's the problem here? And so it seems like from the kind of the structural standpoint in Sacramento that everyone's like, well, what's the big deal? We're doing what we're supposed to be doing when, in fact, that it is a really a big deal. And really, Anthony Rendon and Kevin DeLeon really haven't kind of come out and truly made a strong statement. Now, I have to give Anthony Rendon some credit because Raul Bonegra and Matt DeBabinet both resigned. And you know that was not going to happen without Anthony Rendon really kind of being behind there pushing it, because now Anthony Rendon's lost his supermajority in the assembly because of those two resignations. So that's costing him quite a lot politically. And so he was definitely involved in those resignation decisions. But Kevin DeLeon continues to kind of protect his buddy, Tony Mendoza, which would also, if he, Tony Mendoza, resigns, would lose the supermajority for the Democrats in the Senate. So I'm unimpressed with kind of how the Democrats are handling it in Sacramento. And I say Democrats because so far it's really been kind of the Democratic issue in Sacramento, and they control the assembly. They control the assembly process and the Senate processes. There is a Republican who has also been accused, and the Republicans have remained largely silent against him also, except for Melissa Melendez, who is really the one who's been pushing forward the whistleblower bill that keeps on getting killed in the Senate Rules Committee. Hint, hint, Kevin DeLeon. So it's disconcerting to kind of see the Sacramento culture being so anti-Trump and anti-Roy Moore, which they have every reason to be, particularly on this issue, but then also kind of really kind of protecting their own. And it kind of seems to be kind of this two-step that really is, I think, inappropriate, particularly on this topic.
Well, and for Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador for nationally, for her to say those women deserve their say, and that's a big step, you know, to say something like that. I don't know if you heard just in the last few hours, Ryan Lizza, who's the political correspondent for The New Yorker, has been dismissed for inappropriate sexual behavior. So it's, I mean, people are losing their jobs. This is definitely serious. It's just a question of accountability.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
It's interesting. Literally, as he was saying Nikki Haley, I was handed a card which says, Nikki Haley said on CBS this morning that accused women had a right to be heard. Will she survive?
Well, it was, I mean, there was a lot of talk about how she parsed this and was she able to say it. But she was asked, John Dickerson asked her specifically, are you saying that the election settled the issue? And she said, not necessarily. You still get to be heard. And for the White House now to double down, which they've done, a very contentious, I'm retired, so I don't have anything to do, so I watch the CNN stuff all the time. And, you know, Sarah Huckabee Sanders had a very contentious session with reporters today, and she said there are eyewitnesses that will discount these allegations. And they said, who are they? And she said, we'll have them later in the day. We'll be able to. And this head of a pin that we've been dancing on here is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. If the two people that we think they're talking about for eyewitnesses are not credible and have not been credible throughout. One guy is a British citizen who has repeatedly and publicly been embarrassed by trying to float these crazy conspiracy theories and has been called out. That's your guy. That's going to be the guy that's going to. So, as much as we spent time on the Russia investigation and so forth, it may be at the end of the day that it is sexual harassment.
Someone asks, "What do we think will happen in the Alabama Senate race tomorrow?" Someone else says, "Where will the Roy Moore Victory Party be held?" We know that it'll be at the food court at the mall.
But the candidate can't be there.
Yeah. Any thoughts? I mean, we were talking earlier. The polls are all over the place on Alabama.
I said to John earlier, SurveyMonkey, which is here is local, took the same data and issued 10 different projections. you know, saying, you know, likely voters could come out this way. And they were able to, with all those 10, to have Roy Moore winning by 9 points and Jones winning by 10 points at different times. But I think it's interesting. Barb and I were talking. The Fox News poll has Jones winning by 10 points.
It's hard because people, you know, when they're talking to a poll, of course, SurveyMonkey is all online, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have to worry about talking to When you're talking to a person, I could see in that state some people saying, being, you know, embarrassed to say I'm voting for the child molester, so I'm going to break down and vote for the Democrat. But I could also see people being embarrassed to tell a pollster that they're voting for a Democrat in that state. So I don't know how you poll.
Yeah.
Well, at 538 did a thing saying that at this point, over half of the people in the United States don't have a landline. They've got a cell phone. And those are harder to get. So if you're going to make a phone survey, it's harder to get people to get a representative sample. And if you end up calling landlines, you end up calling older people who skew conservative. So are you getting a true picture of what these people really want to say? It's not that easy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Someone asked, we'll use this as our exit question on this topic, which is worse for Republicans, Roy Moore winning or Roy Moore losing?
Yes.
I mean, some people have made that argument that if Roy Moore wins, the Democrats get to run against him for the next.
Lindsey Graham said that today. He said a Roy Moore victory is the gift that keeps on giving for Democrats. Yeah. And people have actually said the robocall that mm-hmm. Trump made may very well end up in some political campaigns being played for Democrats around the country. Mm. This is a very, you know, it's a focused situation in Alabama, but that's not the case around the country. No. People don't feel that way.
Yeah. I think it's definitely worse if he wins for Republicans. Oh. They have to figure out, do they vote to expel him, which they absolutely should if he were he's unfit for office well before the pedophilia stuff came out.
Really.
Let's just make that clear. And this just kind of doubles down on that. So, I mean, he has no right to be a U.S. senator than the man on the moon does. But they have to figure out that because that has ramifications back in Alabama. Does that make him a martyr? And then does he become that nasty wart on the side that never really seems to go away, no matter how much acid you put onto it? And
you're scaring me, Chris.
But then he becomes this rally cry for Republican or for Democrats across every single competitive state, and I think it could put kind of marginal states into competition, mm-hmm. Particularly at the Senate level, but also then at the district level for the House races. If he loses, they get Doug Jones for the remainder of the term. Alabama's a red state. That's he's going to flip back to Republicans the next time there's an election. So it's kind of the Democrats will be holding it on reserve for a short period of time. It's not that big of an issue electorally. Now, it does make the math a little bit harder for the Republicans on the Senate map, but they have a nice, they have a decent buffer as it is already in the Senate map going into 2018. That shouldn't concern them. So they should be praying that he does not win tomorrow evening.
For lots of
reasons.
If he doesn't win, then President Trump's coattails are once again proved to be pretty short.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he got into this late because he thought he could win. So if he loses this, and he was mad about Luther Strange, if he loses this, it's going to be another example. And it all has ramifications for 2018 for the upcoming midterm election.
Well, let's stop looking forward. Let's look back. Let's do a little bit of a year in review. We had a number of things I wanted to ask our panelists about, and, you know, important and significant people and trends and other things throughout the past year. So I wanted to start with, who do you think was the most important person politically in 2017? Chuck, let's start with you.
It's Donald Trump, right? It is. It's just, you know, an unexpected win, an unexpected election, unconventional president. He's upended everything. He's the constant topic of discussion. He's, you know, I'm in my 60s. I've never had a president like this. It's amazing. I don't know that I've ever been so angry, so upset, so intrigued, so just unable to stop watching. It's just...
Yeah.
That's a slow motion car wreck for 4 years, isn't it?
Okay. Barbara, how
about
you?
What he said.
Are we three for three then, Carson?
No, because I kept mine all California related. Okay.
So,
because I knew, I felt like they're going to go to Trump, so I was wanting to be a little bit different on this end. I actually chose Anthony Rendon, the speaker of the assembly. Huh. He's proven himself to be, kind of, I think, really a kind of a political mastermind when it comes to trying to navigate the assembly, which is definitely the most ideologically diverse chamber in Sacramento that has really kind of distinct factions within his own caucus on the Democratic side, but then also very distinct factions on the Republican side, a more moderate wing versus the more conservative wing. And he was able to kind of navigate those to get cap and trade reauthorized and moving forward again with the help of many Republicans. But he also was able to kind of navigate those hallways and killed single payer, much to the chagrin of his more progressive Bernie Sanders wing of the Democratic caucus. So I have to give it to Anthony Rendon.
Very good. We asked folks out in the during the reception their views of this person, and there were quite a few Donald Trumps, of course, but also the Mercers, Susan Collins, Nancy Pelosi, the Me Too hashtag, you know, certainly have been changing things, so all good suggestions. Let's be positive here. What was the best thing to happen politically in 2017? Barbara.
The women's movement. I would say, and not just because I'm a woman, the marches were great. Marches all over the country, hundreds of thousands of people, not a single fight. But I hear all the time now from local groups that are women working in politics, working into politics. There are a couple of different groups recruiting women to run for office. In Virginia, you saw not only Democrats winning, but a lot of women winning in the Virginia elections, which is not all that common in Virginia. I think we'll see where it goes. Ironically, Roy Moore winning will, I think, energize that group yet more. But that's my takeaway.
Okay. Chuck?
Well, I would agree with that, but I would take it from the standpoint of a male, which is I was so in the dark about this. When I would hear these things about people exposing themselves and pushing women up against the wall, and, you know, you really thought that would be an effective way to meet a woman? And to talk to women and say, boy, that seems way out of line. It seems crazy, doesn't it? And they would say, no, it really doesn't seem that crazy. And to go home and say to my wife, boy, I'm hearing from all these women. She said, yeah, I had the same experience. You know, I worked at she worked at a ski resort and had this. I mean, I think it's been a tremendous development because it's been such an eye-opener to half of the population who are men who realize that it was a lot tougher. This is a lot tougher than we realized, and I think that's just a positive up and down the line. If it's positive in how we hopefully remember how to speak to each other, and if we realize that we don't discount these things because it's just boys being boys, or it's not that big a deal. It is, and I think that's been one of the great eye openers of the year and maybe the last 5 years for me.
Okay, and Carson?
Okay, I continue to be the odd man out here.
We love that about you.
But yeah, follow me on this one, guys. Okay. So I think the best thing politically is actually Kevin Falconer, the mayor of San Diego, deciding not to run for governor. Okay, so follow me here. So for what reason number one? A, it's brilliant for his own political career because that was going to be a pathway to nowhere for him anyway. But more importantly, if he were to have run, the California GOP probably would have done a fairly decent job of clearing the field for him, which would essentially meant that the race would have been Kevin Falconer versus Gavin Newsom, which really would have been an uncompetitive, boring race that really wouldn't have talked about any of the major issues facing the state of California. Moreover, it would have really kind of glossed over all the serious problems facing the California GOP. The California Republican Party really needs to face its demons. If they continue kind of putting up people like Kevin Falconer and these standard bearers that are good individuals and good politicians and good Republicans, they're not really kind of facing their demons. And so they really need to do that in order for the party itself to really kind of resurrect itself. Now, because he's not in the race, the California Republican Party can start to face its demons, and I think that they are slowly starting to realize kind of the more banal parts of the party that have taken over itself and really starting to decay the true foundations of the California Republican Party. But also, we have a chance to actually have a competitive gubernatorial election, the first one since really 2010, where we can actually have a true debate on the topics really facing California. Gavin Newsom does not have a fast track to the governor's mansion anymore. He's going to have to fight for it. He's going to have to talk about the issues. There are going to have to be real debates, whether it's between him and John Chung, or if it's him or Antonio Villaraigosa, or maybe someone else. Who knows? But at least we're going to actually have a true campaign, a true debate now. And that's really important for California, because we do have serious systemic problems that need to be addressed that the next governor is going to have to address. Otherwise, that debate wouldn't have happened, I think.
Okay. We'll stay with you for the next category to start with. Okay. The worst thing to happen politically in 2017.
Sticking with California, I think it was the gas tax increase. For some policy reasons, I think it really kind of doesn't allow California to really truly get to understand kind of how the future of infrastructure funding ought to be in the state. A state that's increasingly not as reliant on gas to really kind of fuel our vehicles, that's more kind of focused on mileage and some other issues. But also, I think the Democrats put themselves in a bit of a pickle by having the gas tax funds go into the general fund versus creating a special fund for these infrastructure funds, because it really opens them up to a lot of political hits that this funding really isn't going to go to roads, because we've seen increase in the budget already, and very little of that money has gone to roads. So why will this money go to roads? And so it really has opened them up to a really harsh attack when it comes to when we see this gas tax repeal on the ballot, which most definitely will. Now, on the flip side, Republicans have kind of put all of their eggs in this basket. This is going to be our savior. This is going to be our saving issue. This is going to get us back to some sort of relevancy in the state. And that's a really kind of a fool's errand, because this is one issue that, Californians will care about. But this is an issue that is already baked into the pie when it comes to how people view Republicans, and it's not going to really do much for them beyond that. And so they're going to spend a lot of time and effort and funding while not really paying attention to the true things that really matter when it comes to really trying to revitalize their party.
Okay. Barbara, the worst thing.
Going back to national, I think the thing that scares me most about this year is the beginning of the changes in the courts, and not the Supreme Court yet, because that's sort of a status quo, but the people who are being nominated to lower courts and being nominated by President Trump and others and will be approved, I think, because of the majorities. There are anti-science folks out there. There are people who have never, barely practiced law who are getting nominated to the courts. And the reason I think it's so bad is that it lasts forever. I mean, these guys, even if Donald Trump is a one-term president, those folks are with us for a long time.
Chuck?
Well, I think it's the national assault on many of our institutions, and I'm going to pick the news media because I'm in the news media. But the idea of attacking people, as Sarah Huckabee Sanders did today, and said, the one thing that upsets me is when the news media reports something that they know is not true, and yet they report it to undermine the presidency. That is the core of what we do, you know. We strive to get it right. That's why all the President's Men, we're still watching all the President's Men. That's why we got into journalism, is we're trying to be the impartial judge. And to imply it repeatedly that this is an agenda, that this is fake news, that people know that this is incorrect. A week ago, a week ago, the president said ownership, black household ownership of homes is at the highest rate it's ever been in history. Not even close, okay? It was 2004 was the height. It's declined ever since then. He said stuff like that over and over. And then to take people, and mistakes have been made, and that happens, but those, like ABC, they made a mistake with the report. ABC suspended that guy. That's what happens. And I admit we're a bunch of fragile flowers. We just can't stand to be criticized like this. But that really is at the core of what you do. You know, you will, an editor will say to you, is that exactly what that person said? Is that exactly correct? I mean, that is baked into every moment of being in journalism. And the idea that you can dismiss this with, well, you just have an agenda, and you're just, you know, who knows, you're going to write all kinds of stuff, is really troubling. It's troubling to me, and I think it should be troubling to the country. Calling the FBI in tatters is troubling. You know, impinging the intelligence community is troubling. All those kinds of things. But I happen to be in the media business, and that upset me. And it really upsets, I know, a lot of people. And it just seems so careless. It doesn't seem like it's been thought through. It's just like, yeah, they just make stuff up. No,
see,
they don't.
I disagree that it's careless. I think it is a very concerted undermining.
Yep.
Undermining the media is a tried and true technique.
Yep.
For a regime like Donald Trump's. And
yep.
Yeah. But otherwise, I agree with you.
Okay.
My own choice for worst political happening of the year was Charlottesville.
That's good.
The response
that's
to good. That. What about the biggest political surprise of the year, Chuck?
My biggest surprise has been that after the election, the antipathy to the Clintons and Hillary Clinton. I did not see that coming. And Donna Brazile wrote this book, and it's not a favorable portrait. And I think that there was a sense in the Democratic Party that they got a little steamrolled. And again, I just didn't see it. Hillary Clinton made the point that any young girl could look at her and say anyone can become president. And that was such a emotional and thoughtful and, you know, inspirational narrative. And yet I think there were a lot of sharp elbows in that campaign, and mm-hmm. it really makes you rethink. And I think the Democratic Party is at this point thinking, where do we go from here?
Yeah.
Right now we had this first family that went through this thing. Now what are we doing? And I think we're struggling with that as a Democratic Party. And I'd like to see those new faces and see those new people and hear those new ideas.
Barbara, biggest surprise?
I separated Me Too from the women's marches and activism and so on. That really stunned me. Harvey Weinstein didn't, but when it moved into the political arena and just kept going, that was a shock to me. And while I fear that it will not have the long legs that we hope it will as far as making change, it was a stunner to me, continues to be.
Carson?
Yeah, it has to be just how all in the California Republican Party has gone into the pro-Trump sort of mania.
Mm.
Just from a policy perspective, a political perspective, it makes zero sense whatsoever. And it just seems like they continue shooting themselves in the foot on it, but they continue to kind of just keep on going all in, whether it's the elected officials, but also the activists and the donors. And it continues to perplex me because I just don't see how a party the whole point of a political party is to win elections. That's why you form a political party. Am I wrong?
No. Sounds right.
So to do this, you're essentially negating any ability of you to win in a state like California. It just goes beyond belief whatsoever that every kind of aspect of the party infrastructure isn't stopping and saying, wait a minute, what, this doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
In our informal survey out in the other room, audience members were pretty much along one line. They mentioned Al Franken, Charlie Rose, John Conyers, Roy Moore, Garrison Keillor, and then Michael Flynn for presumably other reasons. Finally, the most overlooked but still important political development of the past year, Carson.
I'll finish off with something California related, keeping with my theme here. And it was actually last week, Mike Schellenberger, who is an environmentalist and founder and CEO of the Breakthrough Institute, which is an environmental eco-modernist think tank in Oakland, announced his candidacy for governor of the state of California. If you don't know much about Mike Schellenberger, I highly encourage you to check him out. Fascinating individual, whether you like his platform or not. He definitely, I think, has the ability to really kind of reshape things when it comes to the debates and the topics that will be discussed going into the 2018 election.
Hmm. Barbara?
I think we are missing as a trend all of things that are happening under the headlines now. President Trump is signing many executive orders a week, changing environmental and labor and lots of different policies that do not have to go back to Congress. Some of them may fall in lawsuits. We have folks you have Ben Carson, housing, who doesn't really believe in helping people with housing, and EPA and Interior, folks who don't believe in the missions of those departments, and on and on. And I think we have yet to take a big picture look at what is happening. There's always, when you've had a tendency to add regulation, there's always, it's a good idea to go do, take a look and do some rolling back. Every Republican administration has done that so far. But it's been nothing like this. I mean, I think we're going back to the 50s on some of this. It's not my idea of the best place to go. So I think we need to take that stand back look at what's been going on while we're hearing about the outrage of the day.
Okay. And Chuck?
You're going to tell me, John, I'm forgetting the term here, but internet independence, what's the...
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality.
Net neutrality is going to be huge. And This is the idea that you can block things. If you're controlling an internet provider, you'll be able to block things even though they're legal. You'll be able to charge more for certain things. People and providers who have a certain amount of money will be able... It's going to be a big deal. And it's something that we don't think about. We don't really see it happening. Our internet is, we sit down and check our email. Everything is fine. Net neutrality is huge. It's going to be a big deal. And it's headed, in my view, the wrong direction right now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that.
Okay. A couple short items I want to get to before we get to the news quiz. Last week, President Trump said the United States is recognizing Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, though it wasn't going to moving its embassy there. That might be something that takes place over 3 weeks. Barbara, why is this such a big deal? Isn't he just recognizing the facts on the ground?
It just has been the basis of diplomacy for so many nations for such a long time. And it is a highly symbolic move. It does, the Knesset meets in Jerusalem. But whether President Trump intends for it to or not, he says he does not, it clearly places him on the side of Israel and undermines, I think, whatever hope there has been of a peace process. I think it's interesting that everybody from Saudi Arabia to France is up in arms. I mean, it's not just our European allies, it's everyone.
Chuck, you're nodding. So.
Why? I mean, why do this now? I mean, why pick a fight with North Korea? And why do this now? I mean, it's been mentioned, it's been talked about for administration after administration, and the answer is it's donors, it's Sheldon Adelson in Las Vegas. I mean, he wanted this done, but it's another example of just sticking your finger in somebody's eye for no good reason. And I don't know how many people have been hurt or injured or died doing this, but why is just the question you have to keep asking.
Carson, was it a good move politically, at least, for his base? I mean,
politically, yes. I mean, it was a good move. I mean, it's something that he's promised in the campaign, so he kind of, I guess every Republican candidate kind of promises it. But he kind of needed to fulfill one of his promises. and so this was kind of an easy one to do because it is symbolic. Granted, they may start moving diplomatic kind of missions to Jerusalem, which has then serious kind of security concerns for the diplomats and their families. And I think that's really ultimately kind of it. Does this put American lives in danger? And if ultimately, yes, it does, then that's really a bad idea. If it doesn't, And it really is just purely for kind of a diplomatic posturing from the Trump administration perspective, then it's going to continue being, you know, how the Trump administration was going to do their diplomacy anyway. Was there really going to be peace negotiations in a Trump administration between the Palestinians and the Israelis? No. There was not. I mean, if anyone, the Europeans would really be taking the kind of the action on that. So it remains to be seen kind of what actually impact I think it has ultimately going to do. I think there's a lot of initial reactions to it because it really did kind of come out of nowhere. And I think that's kind of how the Trump administration acts. They kind of throw these bombs out there to try to kind of deflect and distract and then kind of move on to another topic and try to kind of they're weaving back and forth as they kind of move through their agenda.
Just real quick, in the Sunday New York Times, there was a story from the correspondent who lives in Jerusalem. And the entire story was how on edge that city is every single moment. That every time you hear something, you think it's an explosion. And he talked about schoolgirls coming across intersections and glaring at drivers, like, are you gonna stop or not? That is such a powder keg. And I just find it hard to believe you struck a match.
Yep. Finally, the L.A. wildfires. Carson, you actually came up here from the L.A. area. What have you seen? It's not anywhere near where you are, right? It's further north.
Yeah.
Are things getting better? Are they getting worse?
Unfortunately, it seems like particularly the Thomas Fire, which is in Ventura and now spreading into Santa Barbara counties, the containment is oscillating back and forth. They seem to kind of make some efforts, and then kind of the winds change, or the Santa Ana winds really kind of ramp up again, and the fires continue to kind of push forward. There, it's now starting to really push into the more dense populated areas of those counties, and so it is a major concern. We had a few smaller ones that popped up that did some serious damage within the LA metro area too. And I really think it's what we see with these ones in Southern California, the ones that just occurred in Sonoma and Napa counties. I mean, these fires really are becoming the new normal for the state of California, just like the prolonged droughts that we just came out of are the new normal for the state of California. And yes, it is connected, I think, in some capacity to climate change. And Jerry Brown is traveling all around the world talking and preaching about climate change. But back home, he and his friends in Sacramento really aren't talking about, okay, well, what does this mean for the state of California? How do we prepare? How do we adapt? How do we ensure that we are ready to go with this new normal, with potential of having these massive droughts followed by wildfires? Because this is going to be a recurring situation for us over and over and over again. And thus far, state policy really hasn't thought about, okay, how do we now start to kind of prepare for this into the future? Because this is what we are going to have to be living with moving into the future.
Barbara, do you agree? I mean, is this, are we unprepared?
I do. And more specifically, the way both the state and the federal government deal with fighting the fires, is they take, after they run out of a small firefighting budget, they start taking money out of the budget for fire prevention. And because it's fire, and there it is. But we're doing less and less prevention, and that's partly because Congress has had trouble agreeing on what we should be doing for prevention, because half of Congress is beholden to environmentalists and the other half is beholden to loggers, to generalize. I mean, and they have very different ideas about how you prevent fires. Certainly cutting down the trees is an effective way to prevent forest fires. But, I mean, the environmentalists are just as bad. It's terrible. Need to get their acts together to have prevention plans, to get communities more engaged, you know, the way we landscape clearances around houses. There just has to be a huge change in the way we think about things, even neighborhoods at the edges of cities, as we saw in Santa Rosa.
Yeah. I mean, Chuck, the North Bay fires, I mean, what sort of impact did they have on economics and even psychologically?
Well, we were saying before, I hate that I've become so inured to these stories. I mean, I see these stories, and I don't always read them. It's the same story. We left in the middle of the night. Oh, my God. We jumped in a car. We escaped with everything. We came back. There's nothing left. We were up in Washington State about 4 months ago, and they were having terrible wildfires. And I parked a car in the hotel parking lot. When I came out, it was covered in ash. I mean, it's not a California problem. It's a bigger problem. Mm-hmm. And addressing it is important. Is this the new normal? Mm-hmm. If it is, we need a new normal response.
Right.
And I don't know what it is, but it's just unfortunate that we become so accustomed to this that we say, yeah, fires, that's tough. That's really hard. I was telling you, I was up at Cotati in Calistoga. And I was talking to a guy. He wanted to talk about the newspaper business. And these two women came up and said, are you guys talking about the fire? And we said, yeah. And they told their story about the neighbor that woke up in the middle of the night in their little cul-de-sac and ran from door to door and knocked on the door and said, get up. Everybody has to go. We have to leave right now. And they left in their pajamas. They got in their car and drove out and came back, and there was nothing there. That's a horrible tragedy, and yet it's another story that we've already heard that story, and you can't get to the point where you don't think that that's a tragedy and that something has to be done.
Well, on that note,
upbeat. Sorry.
Yes, we'll see what we can do with the news quiz to brighten things up. We're now going to do our news quiz. Colette, I believe, is my prize delivery person. I'm going to read a question. If you think you know the answer, raise your hand, and you can shout it out then. If you do win, then let other people win for the rest of the game. Now, the first prize, actually, someone came up to me before this program. They had two tickets to tomorrow night's Commonwealth Club program with Daniel Ellsberg.
Huh?
He can't use them, so that's the first prize. If you win the first one, you get the two tickets. So, question is, the prime minister of what country this week claimed to have defeated ISIS in its territory? Way in back there, sir, in the dark shirt?
Iraq,
that's correct. See me after the program, and I'll give you the info for the tickets. Okay, so now for the chocolate prizes. A reward of $100,000 to be paid in bitcoins has been offered for a Michigan couple for the return of what? There were actually four of these that they want returned. Did anyone see the story? I don't see any hands. Okay. They had four cats, two of which are in the Guinness Book of World Records. And okay. Alex Kaczynski is a judge for the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals here in San Francisco. He's being accused of what by multiple former clerks right there in the second row?
Sexual misconduct.
Sexual misconduct. That is correct. And that includes having them watch pornography and then questioning them, making inappropriate sexual comments.
Oh.
Okay. Paris, the city of Paris, not Paris Hilton, Paris came to a standstill as hundreds of thousands paid tribute to what recently deceased rock star? Ma'am, your hand went right up. Sorry?
Johnny Holiday,
that is correct. Okay. In a video that quickly racked up millions of views, a crew from conservation group Sea Legacy filmed what animal starving in Canada's Baffin Island? Well, you all kind of said it, so I can't really ask the question. We'll do another question, but yes, it was a polar bear, a very sad question. The Coptic Christian Pope, as in the Egyptian Coptic Church, canceled a meeting with Vice President Mike Pence in protest of what? Sir, right? That's right, the move of the recognizing Jerusalem as the... sir, raise your hand so she can... Okay, a number of prominent black leaders boycotted President Trump's speech where on Saturday? Sir, in the yellow, way in back.
Selma?
No. Sir, in the...
Mississippi Civil Rights Museum.
That's right, the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson, Mississippi. Following the completion of 100 years of construction... And had the Commonwealth Club just, it felt like we took us 100 years to build this. But following the completion of 100 years of construction, thousands of people gathered on Friday at the now completed structure in Washington. What is the structure? Did you see the story? Oh, sir.
It's a cathedral.
Right. It's the Basilica of the National Shrine of the Immaculate Conception, noteworthy not only because they have incredibly slow construction, but it's the largest Roman Catholic church in North America. Hmm. Yeah, add it to your next travel there.
Oh, my God. That's dedicated.
Three people were injured and 10 people left homeless after a woman burned down a building in Cincinnati trying to do what? Right along the edge there.
Kill bed bugs
with rubbing alcohol. No one was killed, and the injuries apparently were not life-threatening. But it did cause an estimated $250,000 in damage. So don't do this at home, or anyone's home. According to former Trump campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, during the campaign, Donald Trump would typically order a meal of 2 Big Macs, 2 Filet-O-Fish sandwiches, and a chocolate milkshake. Now, if that sounds like a lot, and maybe not all that healthy, Lewandowski says Trump made it better by not doing what? Right along there. He did not eat the bread. So. In the white there. The Democratic Party's commission, which is tasked with reforming the party, has said the Democrats should drastically reduce what? This is a big point of contention. Way in back there, sir, in the dark.
Superdelegates?
Reduce superdelegates. That is correct. Okay, just a couple more. Don't know if you saw this story. This might be one no one knows. But for one point in November, for a short time in November, TripAdvisor's very best restaurant in London was what?
Oh,
in the blue, ma'am?
Yeah, it was a shed in Duluth.
Exactly. It was a shed. This was a guy who had apparently been paid by restaurants to write fake good reviews of them, decided, hey, if I can write fake reviews, I can make up a fake restaurant. And for a while, it actually was their number one restaurant in London. So. Okay. According to a new news report, who drinks 12 cans? Wait, is that the last one?
Yep.
Oh, we need a better question than that.
Because that was Carson.
Okay.
My Diet Coke.
It is the holiday. So the recession a decade ago is being blamed for a shortage of what this Christmas season? Sir, way in back there.
Christmas trees.
That's right. They planted fewer trees, and now we don't have enough 7 and 8 foot trees. Well, listen, we'll have a lot more questions and, of course, much more to talk about on Monday, January 8th. It's a free for members night. Hope to see a lot of you back there. Back here. Thanks to our great panel, Carson Bruno, Barbara Marshman, and Chuck Nevius. Thanks to all of you. Have a wonderful Christmas, wonderful holiday season, and see you in the new year.